We will proceed with our next and last case, In re Andre Burton, but we'll take a moment or two for the courtroom to quiet down. All right, we'll proceed now in the matter of In re Andre Burton, hearing first from Ms. Romo.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Lisa Romo, and I will be arguing for Petitioner Andre Burton. Mr. Burton has been waiting for 23 years to present witnesses to a jury to show that jury that he was not the person responsible for the capital crime at issue. Mr. Burton was denied that chance when his trial counsel, Ron Slick, decided not to present any defense at all at the guilt phase of his capital trial.
Did your client specifically ask that his trial attorney present a defense, and I think it had to do with an alibi defense or mistaken identity defense?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. He testified at the evidentiary hearing that he asked his counsel to present a defense, that he asked his counsel to present witnesses, the witnesses that we've been...
All right, so I have your answer that yes, your client did express such a desire to his trial attorney, Mr. Slick. Next question then would be, taking a look at this court's decision in Frierson, we there said that if the defendant wants his trial attorney to present a particular defense, the defendant must make that clear very clearly and unequivocally. So, having that requirement, what I need to know from you, other than stating to the court, yes, my client did tell the attorney that he wanted an alibi mistaken identity defense, was that request put forth in clear terms?
We believe that the request was put forward in terms that meets the Frierson standard, which is whether he openly or clearly expressed his desire to present a guilt phase defense. And we believe he did this in two ways. The first way is by directly telling his counsel, I want a defense, I want witnesses. Those included the alibi witnesses and a misidentification eyewitness. But that also there is documentary evidence in this case which, although less specific, also meets the burden of Frierson to openly or clearly express his desire to present a defense.
But at the reference hearing that took place to determine this very issue that we are now considering, I recall that the evidence before the referee on this particular issue was conflicting as to whether your client, petitioner, objected to his trial counsel's decision to not put on a guilt defense other than cross-examining prosecution witnesses. And there were other witnesses who testified on this particular issue. I think the defense investigator, what was her name, Klein?
Christina Kleinbauer.
Thanks for refreshing my recollection. I've forgotten the name or the gender of the investigator, but that's beside the point. Kleinbauer's testimony at the reference hearing was in conflict with her earlier accounts pertaining to her meetings with your client. What is your response there? Isn't that a hurdle that you would have to overcome in this proceeding now before this court?
We don't believe that Ms. Kleinbauer's evidentiary hearing testimony was in conflict with her earlier statements. Her earlier declaration spoke generally to the issues that were raised in the habeas corpus petition, but when this court issued an order to show cause, bringing the Frierson issue into focus, that she was then asked by counsel, did petitioner make clear that he wanted a defense? And she said, yes, he did.
Let me ask you this. We, of course, ordered a reference because we're not in a position to take, you know, testimony, and we decided not to decide this matter based upon the matter presented to us. To what extent should we be giving deference to the referee whom we appointed, given the fact that the referee was in a position to assess the credibility of the various witnesses who appeared on the referenced issues?
I think the answer to that depends on which specific finding the court is referring to. I think there are two general categories of findings he made with a very long list of specific findings. Those two general categories are whether petitioner openly expressed a desire to present a defense and whether there was some credible evidence. I think for both of those standards, this court need not give the referee any deference at all because the referee misunderstood the legal requirements of Frierson on both issues. I also think that...
How does this case differ from Frierson?
How does it differ from Frierson factually or legally?
Well, in Frierson, didn't the defendant make it clear from the outset that he wanted to present a specific defense at the guilt phase?
He did, and I think the factual situation is very similar in a lot of ways. In Frierson, as I read it, it wasn't the defendant himself who said, I want a diminished capacity defense. I can't imagine that he would have been sophisticated to know that that was a legal defense. It was actually his attorney who identified that legal defense and found the evidentiary support for it. What Mr. Frierson told the court is, I want a defense. My lawyer told me that he was going to bring a psychiatrist and some witnesses, and then he didn't put him on. I want a defense. And this court then looked at the totality of the evidence in that case and said, well, it was clear from the beginning that he wanted the diminished capacity defense that his attorney had been talking about. I think it's very similar in this case, in that from the beginning, Mr. Burton had told his attorney, Mr. Slick, he was innocent, he did not confess, he was with friends and relatives at the time the crimes were committed, that the police were lying. There's a list of things that he also questioned the eyewitness identification evidence. He questioned the state's physical evidence. So I think that if you look at the totality of evidence, that it is clear that from the beginning, as in Frierson, Mr. Burton has openly expressed his desire to present a defense in this case.
Getting back to the deference issue, did the referee make any specific credibility findings as to defense counsel Mr. Slick and the defendant here in terms of whether or not, is this an area where credibility is called for, that the defendant did express a desire to put on some specific defenses and counsel says that just didn't happen?
Yes, the referee did make a credibility finding. He found that Mr. Slick's testimony that Mr. Burton never asked for specific witnesses or specific defenses was credible, and he found Mr. Burton's testimony to the contrary not credible. However, we believe that is not entitled to any deference because he overlooked large categories of evidence. He, for example, failed to consider the substantial evidence that we presented that Mr. Slick was biased against petitioner. Although he considered bias when he was assessing the credibility of witnesses who testified favorably for petitioner, he simply ignored substantial evidence that Mr. Slick was biased.
Now, the referee also...
I'm sorry, let me just find out. How did he ignore that? I wasn't clear in your response to Justice Raymond's.
He didn't cite it or discuss it.
Just that he didn't cite it, but we don't know that he didn't
discuss it at all. No, he did not discuss it at all. And I think given the fact that he did discuss and analyze evidence for bias for petitioner's witness means that he was obligated to discuss, at least, he was free to reject it, I understand that, but I think he at least had to show that he had considered it.
Mr. Slick at this reference hearing make the comment, I feel I'm the defendant here.
Yes.
That on the face of it suggests that he wasn't exactly neutral in what his recollections would be of what had transpired in his relationship with Mr. Burton.
I think that's absolutely true, and there was a wealth of other evidence that he was biased against Mr. Burton. He signed several declarations for respondents' counsel. He refused to work with petitioner's counsel. Immediately before the evidentiary hearing, he canceled a meeting with petitioner's counsel, Ms. Morrissey, saying that he wasn't prepared, although he went ahead and met with respondents' counsel.
Well, on that issue, and this gets me back to my initial question pertaining to conflicting evidence, and I think your response was no, there was no conflicting evidence pertaining to defense investigator Kleinbauer's statements. Let's take a closer look at that. At the reference hearing, as the Chief Justice pointed out, this matter was sent out to an evidentiary hearing because of the need to resolve certain evidentiary issues, and these issues were determined by the referee. At the reference hearing, defense investigator Kleinbauer said that your client, Burton, had told Kleinbauer that he really wanted certain witnesses to testify at his trial. But the referee found that earlier declarations by defense investigator Kleinbauer never mentioned that one would think It is an important issue. Certainly, Kleinbauer would have mentioned that in her declarations, but she never did. So, given these circumstances, the referee discredited defense investigator Kleinbauer's testimony for that reason, and then there was another reason. The record shows that defense investigator Kleinbauer was in the early stages of Alzheimer's. The referee also rejected the testimony of the other primary witness for your client, attorney Jeff Broder, who was a friend of defense investigator Kleinbauer. And this particular attorney had represented your client on your client's new trial motion. Attorney Brody testified at the reference hearing that your client's trial attorney, Ron Slick, told him that defendant Burton wanted trial attorney Slick to put on the defense, but that attorney Slick managed to persuade defendant Burton to the contrary. Isn't it significant that attorney Brody had no notes whatsoever of this purported discussion with trial attorney Slick over 20 years ago, and nor did attorney Brody include this particular claim in his new trial motion, even though at the reference hearing attorney Brody admitted that these facts would indeed have strengthened your client's claim of ineffective assistance of counsel by trial attorney Slick. To me, these are hurdles that you would have to overcome. And given the Chief's observation at the beginning of this proceeding that factual disputes, you know, are or were resolved by the referee, if there is substantial evidence to support certain evidentiary determinations by the referee, shouldn't this court defer to those findings?
You've raised a number of questions, and I'm not sure which I should start out with first. However, let me say that even...
Well, to sum it all up, I mean, I don't expect you to respond to every part of my question. The gist of my observation to you is, at this reference hearing, the claims of your client and those testifying on his behalf, based the trial court found, based upon the evidence presented, he found a lack of credibility on the part of the defense side, and he found the testimony of trial attorney Slick credible. Given that evidentiary conclusion by the trial court, it would seem to me that that finding or the findings deserve deference by this court, and assuming that this court were to do so, that is an enormously big hurdle that you would have to overcome in this proceeding.
I have 2 points in my response to that observation, Your Honor. The first is that even if we set aside Mr. Slick's testimony and Mr. Burton's testimony, which were conflicting, our position is there is evidence on the record from which this court can find that Mr. Burton openly expressed his desire to defend. We believe there are 3 pieces of documentary evidence which meet the Frierson standard. This court...
You have to reweigh the evidence, right?
I'm sorry, I can't...
Aren't you inviting us to reweigh the evidence? You're saying, well, there is... I know the referee found to the contrary, but there's evidence in the record, and you people ought to give that more deference than the referee did.
Well, I think No, I'm sorry. My point is that this court can't. Well, yes, I am asking the court to reweigh the evidence. And this court is obligated to look at the referee's findings and see if they are supported by substantial evidence.
Well, that's a different animal. It's one thing for us to look at the record with a differential review and see whether or not there is evidence to support the finding. Mm-hmm. It's another thing for us to reweigh the evidence de novo and act as a new fact finder. Which are you asking us to do?
I'm asking the court to look at the evidence and see if it's supported by substantial evidence, but also I'm suggesting that it's appropriate for this court to look at documentary evidence and make basically a de novo finding because the referee is not assessing credibility at that point. Reviewing courts typically defer to the referee's findings because he's making credibility determinations based on witnesses.
But I agree with the observation by Justice Corrigan, which you, I think, overlooked in responding to the question. Yes, you want substantial evidence because you figured, I think that's required under the law. But then you want de novo. And I agree with Justice Corrigan. You cannot have it both ways.
Well, is it appropriate for us to, for example, to look at the four motions, four Faretta motions that the defendant made in the course of pretrial and trial proceedings? And is there anything in those proceedings that occurred separate and apart from what the referee concluded that we could look at where the defendant, or you could maintain, that the defendant openly expressed the desire to put on a defense?
I believe so, and it's not only those four proceedings, but it's those proceedings when considered in conjunction with the letter he sent, my client sent to Mr. Slick, and the statements he made to Ms. Kleinbauer as she memorialized them in her report, which is Exhibit 1. And a point that I want to make clear, and I don't think I'm articulating, is that the reason that we're asking this court to reject the referee's findings is because the referee is under a misunderstanding of what Frierson requires. We do believe that if a petitioner or a criminal defendant asks for specific witnesses or specific legal defenses, that he has met his burden under Frierson of proving that he has openly expressed his desire to defend. However, we believe there's a more indirect way a client can openly express, and that is, if he makes it clear to his attorney by his actions, by his statements, that he wants a defense, and if he gives that attorney enough information, that information within his knowledge, that allows the attorney to then develop, to determine whether there are legal defenses and some credible evidence to support it, if a reasonable attorney would understand from those actions and comments, that the defendant wanted to present a defense, that we've met the burden under Frierson.
And now the referee concluded from these Faretta motions that they were made for purposes of delay, but not for purposes of showing a disagreement with the no defense strategy.
And I think that's because I'll address the delay separately, but as he looks at the Faretta transcripts, we believe the error the referee has made is he's looking specifically for, did Mr. Burton at some point tell Mr. Slick, I want witnesses, I want a defense? We're saying that the inquiry is broader than that. And so when he evaluated the Faretta transcripts, when he evaluated the letter, when he evaluated Exhibit 1, he wasn't thinking in the correct terms. He was only looking for a specific request,
Basically, you're asking us to give greater weight than the referee did to Ms. Kleinbauer's testimony. It really boils down to that in many ways, doesn't it?
I wouldn't say it boils down to that. That's one part.
But it's one factor, at least. And yet the referee specifically found, with reference to Ms. Kleinbauer, quoting from his report, she was often confused and distracted during her testimony. Much of Ms. Kleinbauer's testimony came as a result of leading questions by petitioner's counsel. Little, if any, weight can or should be given to her current testimony. So you're really asking us to engage in a credibility determination contrary to that made by the referee when the referee was in the position to actually view Ms. Kleinbauer, as she testified.
On that particular point, we are arguing that the substantial evidence does not support that finding. But Ms. Kleinbauer's testimony is a small part of the case that we have presented. I believe that when you look at the totality of the evidence, when you look at Ms. Kleinbauer's testimony, Mr. Brody's testimony, Mr. Smith's testimony, petitioner's testimony, and the documentary evidence, a conclusion that petitioner did specifically ask for witnesses is a much more reasonable finding. But again, our argument does not hinge upon this court rejecting the referee's decision to accept Mr. Slick's testimony over petitioner's. We strongly believe that other actions that petitioner took that are not in doubt, what he said in the letter is not in doubt, what he said in the Feretta hearings are not in doubt, what he told Ms. Kleinbauer is not in doubt. We believe that under Frierson, petitioner has openly expressed his desire to present a defense, and the referee failed to understand that it could be, as it was in Frierson, a more general request, that it doesn't, the referee, for example, rejected those three pieces of evidence because nowhere in them did petitioner specifically say, I want you to call Elizabeth Black, or I want you to do this or do that. But we're saying that no reasonable attorney could have received that letter, received exhibit number one, and heard petitioner's remarks in the trial court and not understood that his client wanted to present a defense and was unwilling to, in effect, concede and have his attorney present no defense whatsoever.
Well, to put this in context, of course, the referee did take into account the fact that there was an eyewitness identification of the defendant. The defendant confessed to this crime, and that the prosecution case was extremely strong. Isn't that correct?
He did, and we've argued that he erred because he refused to consider counter evidence that we presented and additional evidence that we sought to present to show that, in fact, the state's case was not compelling at all, that the eyewitness identification evidence could have been challenged in a very strong manner, that the confession evidence could have been challenged as well. It was an unrecorded confession. It was based solely on the officer's testimony.
The fact that a defendant is dissatisfied with his lawyer and expresses that dissatisfaction in and of itself does not establish a Frierson claim, does it?
Correct. And that's not our argument.
And the referee did conclude, as I recall, that this defendant never did tell Mr. Slick that he wanted specific alibi witnesses to testify at the trial.
That's correct. The referee chose to believe Mr. Slick's testimony on that.
And isn't
point.
Isn't that the heart of this case?
We don't believe so. We believe that under Frierson, a defendant can openly express clearly express his desire to present a defense by making it clear that he wanted to defend, and we think he did that. Even if you just consider the documentary evidence and get away from the he said, she said credibility issue, that there is enough evidence for this court to conclude that he did openly express his desire to present a defense.
So if the defendant tells his lawyer, I'm innocent, and the prosecution evidence is faulty, but I'm innocent, does the defense lawyer commit a Frierson violation by not putting on an affirmative defense?
No, we believe that the defendant would have to do more than that, and in this case, Mr. Burton did. He not only said he was innocent and didn't confess and explained where he was, but when he wrote to Slick, he said, I want you to help me to prove my innocence to the jury. I want you to help me prove that the police officer is lying. I don't want to take a deal. I'm not willing to say I'm guilty. That put Slick on notice that he was unwilling to, in effect, concede. When he got to the trial court, he made similar statements. He said, I want, and this gets back to an earlier point made about why he moved to represent himself. He said that he wanted to represent himself so that he could finish the investigation into his innocence and prove to a jury that he was innocent and that he was unwilling to concede that he was guilty. And I think that those kinds of statements go well beyond, I'm innocent, I got an alibi. And that you're going to find that very rarely in a case.
And any reference during these statements that you just mentioned to there being witnesses to prove his, or that they're not investigating to see if they're witnesses? I mean, besides saying, I want to prove my innocence, did he give any direction as to how that might occur?
You may respond to Justice Werdiger's question, but your time is otherwise up, except for what you've reserved.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal.
Yes, he did. He spent time with Ms. Kleinbauer, who came to visit him, and he very clearly explained where he was, who he saw. He gave names, and Ms. Kleinbauer went out and talked to those people and confirmed. And then when in the trial court, he indicated that he was still working with Ms. Kleinbauer, that he had recently given her more information.
Did this come from Ms. Kleinbauer's testimony? In other words, do we have to disregard the referee's finding that she was not a credible witness in order to find that he had mentioned that he wanted witnesses?
No, we have her report. She Exhibit 1 is her report.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from Mr. Marr now.
May it please the Court.
There Mr. Marr, before you get into a host of issues, the opposing side, Ms. Romo, has argued that leaving the credibility of the witnesses who testified at the reference hearing aside, there is documentary evidence, I think Mr. Romo pointed out, that shows that Defendant Burton clearly, and I use the word clearly because Frierson requires a clear expression, clearly told his attorney, Ron Slick, that Burton, the defendant, wanted Slick to put on certain evidence. Ms. Romo ran out of time. I intended to ask her whether she could be more specific into the so-called documentary evidence that supports her view, but I would like to hear from you. Do you know of any piece of documentary evidence where it supports the defense side or view that Burton, the defendant, clearly told attorney Slick that he, Burton, wanted Slick to put on certain evidence pertaining to alibi, etc.?
I believe that Ms. Romo was first referring to a letter that petitioner wrote to Mr. Slick during the course of the attorney.
Was that the letter, because I think that probably is the letter where, if my recollection is correct, and of course I need help from you on this issue, that was the letter where Defendant Burton proclaimed his innocence.
Correct.
But is there anything in that letter where he told his attorney, and by the way, attorney, I expressly want you to put on this particular defense pertaining to alibi or mistaken identity?
In our position, no. The answer to that question is no, that he did not make clear in that particular letter, he did not make clear or express a clear demand to Mr. Slick, Mr. Slick, I demand or request a particular defense, whether it be alibi or mistaken identification.
But did he claim in the letter that I don't have in front of me, did he claim that he had an alibi, and did he state that he believed he was being framed?
Yes, he did. He mentioned that he was innocent. He believed, he mentioned that...
alert an attorney? I'm not staying with he mentioned he was innocent, because we all know that that's not enough. So, did he claim that he had an alibi, and if he did, would not a reasonable attorney understand that he should pursue that, find out who the witnesses might be?
Your Honor, I do believe that that would provide notice to any reasonable attorney that there are possible defenses to be investigated. And in this case, Mr. Slick did investigate those defenses. He delegated most of the investigative duties and interview duties to his defense investigator, Ms. Kleinbauer.
There were witnesses that defendant hoped could be of assistance to him.
Correct. It appears that this letter that petitioner wrote to Mr. Slick was probably written before Ms. Kleinbauer interviewed petitioner, because this letter is particularly This letter omits any reference to any conversation that petitioner had with Mr. Kleinbauer.
What we're trying to figure out is whether he expressed to his attorney not just that he was innocent, but certain avenues that might be of assistance in showing that.
He certainly suggested that there was a possible alibi defense, but he did not mention by name or by implication.
No, but we're saying the next step is to investigate.
Correct.
You're agreeing that Mr. Slick supposedly did investigate, and
correct,
that the investigator then had the name of witnesses. So what do we do with that?
Again, I would submit that merely indicates that that Mr. Slick had notice of possible defenses to investigate, and that he did do so. However, it is our position that that request or that notice of potential alibi defenses is not sufficient by itself to constitute a clearly expressed demand within the rule of Frierson.
Well, to sum up, getting back to my first question and then, of course, taking into consideration the inquiry by Justice Werdiger and your response to that, here we have this one piece of documentary evidence. You agreed initially with me, you probably still agree, that that letter generally proclaims the defendant's innocence. And then when I asked you, did that letter contain a clear, unequivocal expression of a desire that his attorney, I mean defendant's attorney, put on a particular defense, you said no. But then, of course, Justice Werdiger pointed out, well, going back to the letter, and just like Justice Werdiger, I don't have that letter in front of me. We're talking based upon recollection. You then agreed with Justice Werdiger, yes, in the course of that letter, defendant did talk about a possible alibi defense. And then you readily agreed that, yes, this should have put defendant's counsel on notice that he, defense counsel, should be investigating. And as I was listening to you, I thought, all right, what is the crux of the Attorney General's position on this issue? The one big issue before this court is whether there was compliance with our decision in Frierson. And I would like to hear from you, under Frierson, and I'm I'm paraphrasing our decision in Frierson. It says that it talks about the requirement of a clear, open, and unequivocal expression of a desire for a particular defense. What is your position on behalf of the Attorney General's office? The letter proclaiming innocence in general and telling attorneys like, you know, there is an alibi defense. Was that reference to an alibi defense sufficient to be considered a clear and unequivocal desire that the trial attorney put on the particular defense pertaining to alibi?
Our response would be no. It is not a clearly expressed demand within the meaning of Frierson. Perhaps I want to clarify what I said in response to Justice Werder's questions. Even defense counsel has to operate on parallel tracks. One, under the Sixth Amendment to the federal Constitution, he must be an effective advocate, and he must investigate all potential defenses pursuant to his professional responsibilities. The other sidetrack is that under Frierson, the defendant has certain fundamental decisions where he has ultimate authority over, such as the decision whether to testify on his own behalf, and as under Frierson, the decision to present a guilt-phase defense.
Before you go any further, while we're on the subject of Frierson, and so far I haven't heard anything pertaining to this line of inquiry that I'm about to embark on, I did quote from you certain language from Frierson on page 29 of that particular decision pertaining to clear and unequivocal expression of a clear and unequivocal statement on the part of the defendant that his trial attorney put on a particular defense. But then, on that same page, is this observation by this court. And now I'm quoting, where we said, it is not sufficient for a defendant merely to proclaim his or her innocence or to suggest that certain avenues of inquiry merit further investigation. Does this particular statement have any significance to you?
Correct. The letter that petitioner wrote to Mr. Slick would certainly seem to follow within the category of proclaiming his innocence and proposing certain avenues of investigation that counsel should
And that investigate. Is not enough under Frierson, and that's your point.
Correct, Your Honor.
But what did Mr. Slick do with that letter?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch
that. What did he do with the letter from the petitioner? Didn't he say that he had no recollection of it, what's in his file?
Mr. Slick indicated that he had no current recollection of receiving that letter and or reading it.
Now, the letter is undated. Can you tell, nonetheless, that it occurred before Ms. Kleinbauer, the investigator, spoke with the defendant on June 15th?
The letter is undated, and there are no other indications or notations regarding a particular time period. However, the circumstances of the letter would seem to indicate that it was probably written shortly after the preliminary hearing and prior to the interview conducted by Ms. Kleinbauer.
All right. And Ms. Kleinbauer's report, which is fairly contemporaneous with the events, she noted that the defendant gave her the names of six witnesses?
Correct.
And what type of investigation, if any, was done with respect to those witnesses, and did Mr. Slick personally interview any of those?
Ms. Kleinbauer did interview the witnesses that were mentioned or referenced implicitly during her initial interview with petitioner. Mr. Slick had no current recollection as to whether he personally interviewed them, but he indicated that his notes, which indicated that he consulted with these witnesses, were accurate at the time, and the referee implicitly agree with Mr. Slick's recollection.
And were these witnesses in the nature of alibi witnesses or the nature of going to a misidentification defense, or do we even know that?
The witnesses specifically mentioned by petitioner during his interview with Ms. Kleinbauer primarily involved witnesses who would probably testify in support of a possible alibi defense.
Now, does the defendant have to use terms like I am openly expressing my desire to put on a defense, or to quote words from the earlier case, or words to that effect? Is that sufficient?
The defendant should not be held to a standard where he must use legally sophisticated magic words. But under Frierson, he must make that demand sufficiently clear and open.
Well, in Frierson, they went into chambers, I think. Didn't the defense counsel go there? And the conflict is there on the record, but here it's a little bit more ambiguous. I'm trying to see where we draw the line in defining what openly expressed means.
The demand must be clear enough so that counsel understands that he no longer has authority over normal trial tactics such as the presentation of evidence.
Well, didn't Mr. Slick say at one point that the issue of putting on a defense for defendant was always there between them? It was always there. Now, the record shows that Mr. Slick has admitted that there was tension between them and the issue was always there between him and his client. Is that not sufficient to say that the counsel understood that this client wanted a defense, and we have made reference to one of the defenses that was put forward?
Mr. Slick did indicate that after he evaluated the case and informed his client that under his evaluation of the case, the prosecution's case was very strong, Mr. Slick testified that his relations with petitioner were very poor and that petitioner was essentially non-cooperative and non-communicative with Mr. Slick. Nevertheless, despite the poor levels of communication between petitioner and Mr. Slick, petitioner needed to tell Mr. Slick after Mr. Slick informed Petitioner that his proposed trial strategy was not to present a guilt-phase defense, Petitioner nevertheless needed to object to
Mr.
Slick.
Well, did he not make four Faretta motions, which were a form of objecting to what was happening with his representation? And he had been advised by, I can't remember whom, an investigator, that his best, Frierson, by the way, had not been decided at the time of this trial. So I even have a question about holding this defendant to the particulars of Frierson. But he had been advised that a Faretta motion would be the best way for him to bring his concerns to the court. And he made four Faretta motions.
Correct, Your Honor. He did make four Faretta motions within a span of about a week. However, the last two Faretta motions were basically, he said, he basically did not add any further information. This court on direct appeal in 1989, in considering the Frierson issue, looked at these Faretta motions because these Faretta motions were proposed by petitioner's counsel on direct appeal as evidence of a demand for a Frierson defense.
Well, that, the whole purpose of a habeas is to bring in information to the court that we don't have on direct appeal.
That is true, but my position is that these Faretta motions did not indicate an express demand, as this court found.
These Faretta motions, were any of them predicated on Mr. Slick's refusal to present the defense that the defendant desired?
No, Your Honor. Petitioner did not state in any of these four Faretta motions that Mr. Slick was refusing to present any witnesses that petitioner had requested Mr. Slick to present. As to the question of bias, Justice Werder mentioned Mr. Slick's testimony that he felt like he was the defendant in this case. I would submit that that was not necessarily indicative of bias toward petitioner. It probably was more indicative of some hostility or discomfort with petitioner's counsel. Mr. Slick has been counsel in many.
That, just in all fairness, would perhaps indicate something about the testimony that would be coming forth from an individual who has stated that he believes, he feels like he's the defendant.
That is true, and I would note that the referee expressly referenced this testimony and mentioned this testimony in his summary of the evidence that was adduced at the reference hearing. So certainly the referee considered this testimony by Mr. Slick in evaluating the relative credibility of petitioner vis-a-vis Mr. Slick, especially in regards to the decision or any conversations regarding a demand for a guilt-phase defense. Ultimately, the Frierson issue, in this case, ultimately boils down to a factual issue. There were only two parties to a conversation regarding the demand for a guilt-phase defense, petitioner and Mr. Slick. The referee heard the live testimony of both witnesses. He considered their testimony, evaluated them on a live basis, and he found Mr. Slick more credible in regards to...
Has there been a case that you are aware of, and I would ask opposing counsel as well, where in habeas corpus circumstances where we have sent something out for reference and we get findings back from the referee, where, and we all understand that the referee's findings are entitled to great weight, where this court has ever nevertheless disregarded the referee's findings and made different findings?
I do recall in my research that I believe this court has disregarded referee findings in the past. I do not have that specific case in my mind at this point.
Would you characterize this as a particularly thorough report? I believe it's 32 pages, single space, with findings of credibility and a report that encompasses a hearing that lasted 14 days.
I would believe that it is a very detailed and exhaustive report. As you indicated, it is 32 pages. It was a lengthy reference hearing. There were 16 witnesses who testified over a span of 2 weeks. The referee heard the testimony. It was fiercely litigated by very able trial counsel. And the referee gave an accurate summary of the evidence, and the referee gave a detailed explanation as to his particular credibility findings, and a detailed analysis and explanation in reference to the 11 specific reference questions that this court propounded to the referee. And I want to go back somewhat to the question regarding deference to the referee's factual findings. I believe deference is particularly appropriate on those factual issues where it involves direct testimonial conflict and evaluations of witness credibility. And this is what we have in this case. Petitioner said one thing, Mr. Slick said the other. The referee found that Mr. Slick was more credible. And it's these type of credibility findings and factual findings that deserve particular deference in these type of proceedings. Unless this court has any further questions, I would be prepared to submit.
Apparently none. Thank you, Mr. Marr. Ms. Romo, you may argue in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to respond to Mr. Marr's point about deference. The referee's findings are not entitled to any deference if he's operating under a legal error, and we believe he does not understand what is required under People v. Frierson in order to openly or clearly express a desire to present a defense.
Is there anything in the record that supports your statement to the court that in this particular case was a Judge Fahey of the Los Angeles Superior Court who was appointed referee had no clue as to what our decision in Frierson was all about?
No, he had reread Frierson on several occasions. That's not our argument. Our argument is that he misinterpreted what Frierson calls for and that he was looking solely at whether petitioner requested specific witnesses or specific legal defenses. And while that may be enough to constitute an openly expressed desire to present a defense, a more indirect request would also satisfy the burden. And we believe that we have established that petitioner we actually adopt the AG's characterization of the standard. I believe he said, would a reasonable trial counsel understand what petitioner wanted? And we think in this circumstance, yes, from the letter, from what he told Ms. Kleinbauer, from what he said in the four hearings where he tried to get rid of his counsel, a reasonable trial lawyer would have understood that he wanted to defend.
Let me ask you, have we decided a case since Frierson that elucidates what Frierson calls for?
No.
Or is this going to be the case?
This is going to be the case. Frierson is actually a very, very rare occurrence. I re-shepherdized Frierson in preparation for this argument, and I could find only two cases that actually present a true Frierson situation where there was no defense at the guilt phase, where the defendant is claiming that he openly expressed a desire to defend, and where he is claiming there is some evidence to present that to support that defense. And so that's one of those cases is Mr. Burton's, and then there's one other. So it's a very rare occurrence.
Did I hear you correctly? Did you say that since Frierson, no decision of this court has reiterated the requirements of Frierson?
And there have been a number of cases that have cited Frierson, but for related positions. For example, whether the trial court is obligated to inform petitioner of his constitutional right or whether he's required to take waivers.
Well, Frierson, of course, was decided in 79, and I happened to look at some quotes from a capital case decided by this court, People v. Jones, 1991, where we quoted a 1988 decision, which obviously is after Frierson, the People v. Milner decision, and where in 1991, and as I said, an AA, an automatic appeal proceeding, this court said, a defense counsel's traditional power to control the conduct of a case does not include the authority to withhold the presentation of any defense at the guilt / special circumstance stage of a capital trial when the defendant, number one, openly expresses a desire to present a defense at that stage, and when, number two, there exists credible evidence to support a defense. My point in bringing this up was just to make it clear that after Frierson, there have been a couple of cases, including the one I just cited where we reiterated the test of Frierson?
Perhaps I wasn't clear. There have been cases that, including those you cite, that cite Frierson, and in Jones they cited Frierson. However, in Jones, a mental health defense was presented, so it's a very different situation. It was not a case where there was no guilt phase defense.
It would be for us, in this case perhaps, to clarify what openly requested means, or the phrase that Justice Kennard quoted, because here we have factual circumstances where it wasn't as clear as Frierson, where he said, I want diminished capacity, that's what my attorney told me I was going to get. So the phrase, they may have cited Frierson, but the meaning of openly expresses is what's before us, is it not? And you're arguing that Mr. Burton openly expressed, the other side's arguing that he did not sufficiently do so.
Yes, and we're urging this court to adopt a standard that is a common sense one, that's based on a case-by-case situation, to look at the total circumstances of the case and decide whether a reasonable trial attorney would have understood that his client wanted to defend. We think in the circumstances of this case, there's no question that a reasonable trial counsel would have understood Mr. Burton that he wanted to present a defense that involved alibi, misidentification, false confession.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Romo. Your time
Thank
is
you.
Up. Thank you, Mr. Marr. The matter stands submitted, and we are adjourned.